In a surprise move, Jörg Haider has resigned as head of Austria's Freedom Party. Earlier this month, the far-right Freedom Party joined the conservative Christian Democrats to form a coalition government that has alarmed Europe. Karen Engel has more on the story.
In announcing his resignation, Haider said he did not want to get in the way of the government. Haider raised alarm throughout Europe and beyond for racist remarks and insensitive comments about the Holocaust. The European Union has slapped diplomatic sanctions on Austria, and some countries like Belgium have called for even stronger measures. Haider's resignation does not immediately affect the coalition. Haider said he wants to concentrate on his job as governor of the province of Carinthia, from where he still intends to supervise party activities. The opposition Social Democrats have called Haider's resignation a tactical maneuver, and other political analysts speculate that Haider wants to provoke a break with the conservatives and get elected as chancellor if new elections are called. For NPR News, this is Karen Engel in Austria.
A day before Virginia's primary vote, Senator John McCain has called evangelist Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson agents of intolerance. McCain said that he was not attacking religious conservative voters, but only a few of their self-appointed leaders. He said that his anti-abortion position has been wrongly represented because he does not pander to the two men. And he charged that Texas Governor George W. Bush is a Pat Robertson Republican who cannot defeat Vice President Al Gore in a presidential contest. Bush has accused McCain of playing the religious card. A spokeswoman for the Bush campaign says that he has support from the entire spectrum of the Republican Party. So far, computer operators are reporting no major problems as Leap Day approaches North America. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Tomorrow is the first time there will be a leap day in a century year since 1600 AD. Century years usually have no leap day, except when the year is divisible by 400. There's been some concern that errant programmers might have forgotten to build in that exception, and that could confuse some computers when the date changes to February 29th. Computers at Japan's weather agency did print out the wrong date, but generally few problems are expected. Most computer programs were checked for leap year anomalies when programmers weeded out Y2K bugs. Nevertheless, international Y2K authorities are on alert as the date change sets in, and the White House Y2K office will gear up again just in case. Even if leap year problems do confuse computers, the most likely problems are expected to be billing errors or simple date problems, not computer shutdowns. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street closed mixed as the Dow Jones Industrials added 177 points to end at 10,038, but NASDAQ lost close to 13 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case involving a woman's privacy in drug testing. The High Court will hear a case involving a South Carolina hospital and decide if patients who are pregnant may be tested for drug use and police told when these tests are positive. The hospital in question discontinued its policy in 1993 after a lawsuit was filed. At that time, police had arrested 30 maternity patients. Officials in Mozambique are calling for help from private boat owners to rescue thousands of flood victims stranded in trees and on rooftops. NPR's Kenneth Walker has more on that story.
While calling on local boat owners for help, officials in Mozambique also issued an urgent international appeal for more helicopters. Five South African military helicopters have rescued nearly 3,000 people from rapidly rising floodwaters in just the last 24 hours. An Air Force official said 944 children have been plucked from the waters. Most of them had lost parents to the floods. According to one estimate, more than 100,000 people are still awaiting rescue, some after up to 4 days without food or rest. As water levels continue to rise, more villages are threatened throughout southern Africa. The region has experienced the worst rains over the last 3 weeks than at any time in a half century. Kenneth Walker, NPR News.
In Georgia, officials say that warm weather and a lack of rainfall could mean a record number of forest fires this summer. Parts of the state have been placed under a fire watch. The state of Georgia is suffering from a 10-month-long drought that is expected to continue. In trading in Europe, the dollar was mixed against other major foreign currencies. I'm Ann Taylor, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoMarriott.com.
It's NPR's All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The composer Kurt Weill was born 100 years ago this Thursday in Dessau, Germany. If you read what music historians and critics have said about Weill's work, you might think that there were two men by the same name. There's the one whose works, like the Threepenny Opera, are beloved by Europeans, and the other who wrote such Broadway standards as September Song and Speak Low, and who is dismissed by Europeans as a sellout. To mark Weill's centenary, the Brooklyn Academy of Music is staging a long-neglected opera, one that forms a link between the two Kurt Weills. From New York, NPR's Rick Carr reports.
The first Kurt Weill was a smart-alecky 20-something who'd do just about anything to get an audience's attention. Weill wrote music that was born of the European avant-garde, but steeped in old hymns, popular tangos, and jazz, and set to the spastic silent film rhythms of Weimar Berlin. Poet, playwright, and leftist propagandist Bertolt Brecht was the wise guy who wrote the words. For all the lopsidedness in his music, Kurt Weill thought melody was the best medium for carrying his and Brecht's left-of-center ideas to a big audience. Within a year of their first collaboration, the Mahagoni Songspiel, that hunch had made them into superstars. There were bars named after the Threepenny Opera, even Threepenny Wallpaper. Conductor John Maucheri says Kurt Weill learned the political power of melody from one of his musical heroes, the opera composer Giuseppe Verdi.
He's much closer to Verdi than any 20th century composer I can think of. I mean, the music doesn't sound like Verdi, but really when Verdi wrote La Donna Mobile, he knew he was writing a pop tune, and he was knew that it was going to seduce people into watching a story about political corruption, rape, because it was a popular musical event.
The second Kurt Weill wrote music that was more straightforward, more accessible. This composer was so enamored of melody, his critics accused him of sentimentality.
But it's a long, long while from May to December, and the days grow short when you reach September.
Hesper Anderson is a writer and the daughter of playwright and lyricist Maxwell Anderson, Weill's closest friend and collaborator in New York. She says Weill never understood the distinction. He always loved the avant-garde and always loved American music.
He loved this country. And he, you know, you could tell from the music, the German music, Alabama Song, I think, he loved jazz. He was so thrilled at being able to explore this music. To him, it was just as wonderful as, you know, the music he'd done in Germany.
Once Weill got here, he embraced American culture to the exclusion of German. He refused to speak the language, and after World War II, he refused to fly over German territory. Uta Lemper is a singer and cabaret performer who's recorded much of Weill's early work. She says he even changed his name after a fashion.
He wanted to be Kurt and Weill and not Kurt Weill anymore.
Lemper says that's understandable for a Jewish composer who fled a Nazi regime that had labeled his work degenerate.
Everything about Germany in a certain sense and after all was painful for him to look back at. So in that sense, it might have been easier for him to just move on,
He did that by writing an opera of sorts, a historical pageant recounting the story of the Jewish people, known in German as Der Weg der Verheißung and in English as The Eternal Road. It was the last piece of music he wrote in Europe in 1934, and it forms the link between Kurt Weill and Kurt Weill. As he worked in the director Max Reinhardt's home in the Austrian Alps, Weill could gaze across a valley into Germany at the lights of Adolf Hitler's chalet. As Europe hurtled into the abyss, Weill turned the piece into a farewell to everything that was threatened by fascism. The first few minutes of the score sum up that intention. Conductor John Maccheri says Weill starts with a reference to Johann Sebastian Bach's St. Matthew Passion.
When the rabbi first sings, there's a halo around him like the evangelist, and that is Bach. We know somehow in the air that this is serious religious music.
Next, there's a melody that John Maccheri says is infused with the music that Kurt Weill had grown up hearing, the music his father, the cantor, sang in the synagogue at Dessau.
When it's over, the heavenly host sings that melody again, and the bass line moves in a very slow and plodding way, which is like Parsifal. So within the first 4 minutes of The Eternal Road, Weill has given you a reference of the Alpha and Omega of German liturgical music, which is Bach and Wagner, and he's given in the middle of it this beautiful, slightly Hebrew cantillation of his own heart and soul. So he's embraced the entire world, and that is the secret of his power as a popular writer.
In 1935, Weill came to New York to stage The Eternal Road. It was a critical and popular success, but the production was so lavish that it closed quickly. And then it vanished. No one performed it, no one recorded it. Even parts of the score itself disappeared. In the mid-1980s, John Maccheri, who'd never heard the music, found a copy of the conductor's score for The Eternal Road. He and his assistant played through the whole 4 hours at the piano.
And we found ourselves at the end of sections of it just like suddenly looking at each other and inhaling and exhaling because we hadn't breathed seemingly for 5 minutes. And I remember feeling awe and feeling then rage that it had been kept from me my whole life.
John Maccheri spent 15 years trying to convince the world's top opera companies to stage the piece. Last year, the Brooklyn Academy of Music and the Chemnitz Opera in Germany agreed to mount a new production in honor of Weill's centenary. Given Kurt Weill's lifelong interest in using melody to convey ideas, John Maccheri says it was inevitable the composer ended up on Broadway.
With or without Hitler, Weill would have come to Broadway because it was the center of politically active, popularly supported music theater, which is what he wanted. He wanted the people to come.
John Maccheri will conduct The Eternal Road this week at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. He hopes to record the piece later this year. Rick Carr, NPR News, New York.
Kurt Weill's music is represented on the NPR 100, the list we've compiled of the most important American musical works of the 20th century. That's possible because Weill's work made a leap from the opera house to the radio. It happened with the Ballad of Mack the Knife. Weill wrote the song with lyricist Bertolt Brecht for the Threepenny Opera in 1928. 30 years later, Mack the Knife became an American pop hit. The English translation is by Mark Blitzstein. The song is sung by Bobby Darin.
Oh, the shark bay has such teeth there, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth big, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie Heath, babe. So there's never, never a trace of red. Now on the sidewalk, ooh, Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. And someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone be Mac the Knife? There's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know, where a cement bag just drooping on down. Oh, that cement is just, it's there for the weight to dare. Five will get you 10, old Mackie's back in town. Not to hear about Louis Miller, he disappeared, babe, after drawing out all his hard-earned cash. And now Maggie Heath spins just like a sailor. Could it be our boy's done something rash? Yes, to be tawdry. Ooh, Miss Lottie Lenya and Lucy Brown. Now that Maggie's back in town, I said, Jenny Diver, whoa, Sookie Tawdry, look out to Miss Lottie Lenya and old Lucy Brown. Yes, that line forms on the right, babe. Now that Maggie's back in.
The 1959 recording of Mac the Knife, sung by Bobby Darin, music by Kurt Vile. Lotta Lenya once wrote about this tune, "You hear it coming out of bars, jukeboxes, taxis, wherever you go." Kurt would have loved that. A taxi driver whistling his tunes would have pleased him more than winning the Pulitzer Prize.